Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week our guest is the co-founder of POV International and its acting editor-in-chief and U.S. correspondent and a great expert on everything Danish, Anna Greta Rasmussen. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, and don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can also get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. So tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Delete Me and Miracle Made, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting the sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. James, there are events and moments that prove seminal. I think January in Minneapolis may be one. You know, it's hard to believe this is happening in America. Untrained forces that are led by jackbooted thugs are committing murder and mayhem and then lying about it. The White House, Kristi Noem, and Stephen Wheeler all think, they think the public, that we're just idiots. The videos of Alex Preddy's murder are clear cut. He was trying to help a woman who was being pushed down, and then he was attacked by ICE agents. He was brandishing something. It was a video phone, not a gun. They knocked him down. One of the agents took the gun he was lawfully carrying, and then the other agents or others shot him, riddling his body with 10 bullets. Noem called him a domestic terrorist. That's a lie. He was a nurse. An ICU nurse taking care of veterans. He was praised by colleagues. Greg Bovino, who led ICE, he was pushed out. Fine. Good riddance. They all ought to leave. And at the top of it would be Kristi Noem. I'm just disgusted. Someone, by the way, ought to look at that CNN interview that Dana Bash did with Bovino. She caught him in one lie after another. You know, finally, this comes down, James, to two realities. One, Trump wants an inner city race war, if he can. And two, Pam Bondi gave it away when she said, okay, we'll pull the troops out, but first you have to turn over all your voter files. What? This is about trying to fix the election in November. What they ought to gear up to do is get the hell out of Minneapolis.
Well, Minneapolis, but what's happened here, the White House, first of all, is in terrible shape. The polling numbers are just awful. And by the way, they continue to deteriorate. The images of Minneapolis are going to stick in people's minds. Okay, that this is just not going to go away. But now he has a residue of Susie Wiles, okay, and Stephen Miller. Stephen Miller is clearly on the downside. And clearly, Kristi Noem was aligned with him. So there's a huge, huge internal mess within the White House at a time when everything around them is declining. And to the extent that we can do anything, we just have to keep the pressure and attention on this really substantial rift. They got rid of Bovino. They said that son of a bitch back to California, like he never existed. But the aftermath of this is going to be pretty draconian for them. And they're, of course, they're going to leave Minneapolis. You know, if we get in the movie Gandhi, when one of the British imperialists looked at Gandhi and said, you don't expect us to just walk out and leave now, do you? He said, yes, that's exactly what you're going to do. You're going to walk out and leave. That's what they're going to do in Minneapolis. They are going to walk out and leave. But the aftermath is going to be very ugly. The dissension is going to be very ugly. And I predict one thing, the central message of Republican Senate candidates in 2026, when they're asked the inevitable question, what do you disagree with the Trump administration on? The answer is going to be Stephen Miller. Now, he's going to be the fall guy. I can see debate prep right now. But I was never comfortable with Stephen Miller being there. Then, you know, so good Democratic research has got to do anything they can to show that there's some connection there. I think it's a great answer, but it's the answer you're going to hear. And Stephen Miller is and he's got followers, okay? There are people that actually like what he's doing. Not very many in the general public, but I don't see how this guy's going to last much longer. I really don't.
Well, I don't either. You know, it's always easy to blame people like Stephen Miller when the problem, of course, as we both know, is Trump. I think there's two other points I would make here that a week ago I would have said, you know, it's a waste of time. One is impeachment and the other is a government shutdown. You're not going to impeach Trump. That's just a bad, you know, can't be done. But there is a compelling case to impeach Pam Bondi. She may be gone before that is possible. But already you have 150 Democrats. She's totally incompetent. She's surrounded by third raters like Corey Lewandowski. She's a liar. I think, frankly, that most of the public would say, yeah, we ought to get rid of her. If he won't fire, impeach her. Don't think it's going to happen, but I think if I were a House Democrat, I surely as hell would join that chorus. On a shutdown, which could happen in a couple days, I really did think, hey, we don't need to go through that again. But I've changed my mind. I think it would be unconscionable to fund this out-of-control, trigger-happy ICE without major changes that try to assure that something like the killings of Renee Good and Alex Brady won't happen again. Even at the risk of a shutdown, if need be, make the Republicans defend ICE, because that's what it would be about. I'm not sure how it's going to play out, but I hope that I hope this time the Senate Democrats hold tough, because I think some Republicans on that issue will start to cave.
Well, okay, if you think the situation is as bad as I do, and I think it's really bad, I think it's deteriorating. As you know, and I think you and I share this view, we're going to pick up a lot of Senate seats. Let me tell this to our listeners right now. It's not impossible that in the year 2027, Donald John Trump is impeached by the House and convicted by the Senate. Whoa, wait a minute, James. I can understand that. We're going to win the House. Of course, they vote articles of impeachment, but you need two-thirds of the senators, and you're going to end up with 54, maybe. Right? However, in the wake of an electoral catastrophe like we're going to have in 2026, and when the Republican Party looks toward 2028, you might find 15 Republican senators who say, fuck this, I'm going to impeach, I'm going to vote to convict the bastard, because as long as he's around, we've got no chance. I'm not saying this is a 50-50 scenario, but I'm saying this is something that will be on the table. This is something to think about. He is in danger of being impeached and convicted next year. And the math is, you can go, you have, let's just say you end up with 54 Democratic senators. So you got 54, you need what, 67?
You need 13 Republicans.
You need 13 Republicans. That's not impossible to see in the wake of a catastrophic election like they're going to have in 2026. That's not impossible to see when you look forward to 2028 and how the issues are lining up there. The trouble was, when you broke with Trump, you broke with his voters, and you couldn't win an election without his voters. His voters are starting to break for him. It is not impossible. I didn't say, oh, it's going to happen, because I don't know any more than anybody else. But this is a bank shot, but it's one bank. It's not a double bank shot.
Well, it's certainly meritorious. I'm skeptical that it'll happen, but I think you put out a good warning. Let me return, if I can, just a couple things on Minneapolis. One, Todd Blanche, the deputy attorney general, who's proven to be just as bad as the rest of them, said that the idea when Minneapolis and Democrats were seeking an order to make sure they don't get rid of any evidence, said, yeah, of course we're not going to get rid of any evidence. I mean, you know we wouldn't do that. No, I don't know that, Mr. Blanche. I think you would. I don't trust you. I don't trust anyone in this Department of Justice. I think I'm not even sure with an order that forces them not to get rid of stuff, that they would obey it. That's the kind of Department of Justice we have today. The other thing is, I don't know whether I'm sure no federal case will be brought against any of those ICE agents. You can bring cases in state and local courts There is a problem, as our friend Seth Waxman explained to us on Sunday, a so-called supremacy clause. But I think that mainly, which means that basically when there's a law enforcement action by a federal official, that a state jurisdiction can't come in and indict them. But that's when they're doing their job. These people were not doing their job. They were disobeying the law. They were disobeying their mandate. So I think they are going to get out of Minneapolis, James. You're right. But I don't think we've heard the end of Minneapolis.
No. No. Just like we hadn't heard the end of India. Yeah, they're going to get out. But I want to ask, talk about, by the way, this is catastrophic for the United States. The EU and India just finalized this huge trade deal. We'll talk about it during the show, but it's pretty significant. But, of course, you're correct. I wouldn't trust. These people have proven time and time again, you can't trust them on anything. I trust them as much as I trust a fart, which is not very much.
Well, let's say Stephen Miller goes. Does it change anything?
Well, some. I mean, people won't have to look at him again. You won't see us pitching there as
well,
much.
Well, that's a big, reason, James.
That's some comfort. And then, but the kind of people around him in the odious blood and soil, nationalistic, unpatriotic, anti-American views that he holds will still be a substantial part of that administration. The other guy that we're forgetting who still exists is Russell Voigt. In that whole crowd, they haven't gone anywhere. They're just sitting there systematically wrecking the entire federal government right in front of us. And, I guess another thing, too, is all of this, I think Phil Sheridan was one of the originators, kinetic warfare, keep going. Well, this is kinetic politics because we've gone from Epstein to Greenland to Minneapolis. And just knowing him, he's going to pull out of Minneapolis, but he's going to do something else because he feels like he's engaged in the political equivalent of kinetic warfare. He has to keep these scandals going because if he doesn't, remember, if he doesn't, then it all goes back to Epstein. The Democrats should not forget that. And this is my suggestion for the messaging in 2026. House Bill 1 is to subpoena every record associated with the Epstein file and begin an immediate investigation. That's the first thing we're going to do. And I know a lot of good government types don't want to hear this, but the Democrats, when they come back in 2027, they're not there to legislate. They're there to investigate. Because there ain't nothing to legislate. You're not going to get veto-proof majorities on the things that you need to do. You can show it. You can make them. You can force votes. Pick 10 things that are really popular that they can't be for, they'll veto and do it. But your primary mission will be to investigate and bring the truth to the American people. Because I know something and you know something. The American people can handle the truth. They can handle it. I promise you.
Certainly, that's the case. And I think it has to be done methodically. It has to be done carefully. It has to be done selectively because there are so goddamn many things to investigate, right, James. It's just unbelievable. And, we said a couple weeks ago on this show why it would be, absolutely crazy if New York Democrats unseat Dan Goldman, one of the few investigators, really, really top-notch investigators, but there are others, too, who can do it. And they can have a minimal effect on legislation, for instance, appropriations. They're not going to be funding ICE at the levels that these people expect. But you're right. It is going to be it really is going to amount to an accounting. And that's what Trump fears. And I think that, again, going back to the Pam Bondi letter, they plan to do anything it takes to steal this election. And I think the biggest story for the rest of 2026 will be what happens in the fall and are we able to stop them from what will be the most outrageous actions we've ever seen? They will send troops in if need be. They will go. They will take ballot boxes, impound ballot boxes. They will intimidate voters because they know they're headed for what you've been saying for months, a big, big defeat otherwise.
Right. And, you know, if you put your ear to the political ground, you will hear hoofprints in the distance. These are very encouraging hoofprints because the cavalry is coming. The cavalry is going to be led by, I think, in all likelihood, two people, Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland and Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island. When the deluge comes, and the deluge is coming in November, they are not just going to start thinking about how to investigate. They're already doing it. These are not rookies. These are people that know what they're doing and know how to conduct this. And they got people like Congressman Goldman, who's invaluable. Of course, that's why the Unitarians want him out, because he's actually competent. And there are other people. You remember, we got some pretty talented people. And I keep emphasizing that. And when the deluge comes, we're going to be ready for it. I fully believe that. We're not going to be coming, starting up and trying to figure out where everything is. And they're going to have all the staff hired. They're going to have all the lawyers in place. They're going to have all the investigators in place. And when the Congress reconvenes on January 3rd, I guess it is, or something, early January of 2027, they're going to be running. They're hitting the ground running. They're already running. So have faith.
We got James, good people. I totally agree with you. But again, I just want to say we got to be so goddamn well prepared for what's going to happen this fall, because they're going to do things that we haven't even imagined before. It'll make what they try to do in 2020 look like child's play. And I think we will be prepared, but I think that is a danger. So once we get through that.
Look, the people that are in place that are doing this, and Bishop Hall, maybe we should do a show. What are the possible ways they could try to circumvent election? I don't know. I've heard people say they might try martial law. They might try confiscating ballots. I don't know, but maybe we should do a speculative show just on what strategies they might employ and what we should do to defend against these strategies.
That's a great idea, and we ought to do it soon. And I think we will commit to you out there that there's going to be a show sometime, let's say in February, going through this, because it really is, you know, something that could be really frightening. All right, yeah. We'll be back with a lot more.
Protect yourself online with Delete Me. How important is it? I wouldn't say it's as important as breathing, but it's probably pretty damn important, because if you look at what's going on, how people hijack this stuff, enter it, use it, sell it, profit, blackmail, anything you can think of, you'd want to protect yourself from. Unless you're like me and you don't have anything that you're ashamed of. Most people do.
Well, that's for sure. Delete Me makes it easy, quick, and safe to remove your personal data online at a time when surveillance and data breaches are common enough to make everyone vulnerable. With Delete Me, you can protect your personal privacy or the privacy of your business from doxing attacks before sensitive information can be exploited. That's huge, because in 2026, it's easier than ever to find personal information about people online, having your address, phone number, and family members' names hanging out on the internet can have actual consequences in the real world and make everyone vulnerable. As public figures, you always know you can be a target for scammers and worse. But when we found out how many Americans are compromised and at the mercy of criminals, we wanted to fight back. With Delete Me, you'll feel so much better about your security. But more importantly, as family, we know Delete Me is something that can help keep our loved ones safe. Join us and refuse to be a victim. Start taking steps to protect your privacy with Delete Me. The New York Times Wirecutter named Delete Me as their top pick for data removal services for a reason. So don't wait. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/war room and use the promo code WARROOM at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/warroom and enter the code WARROOM at checkout. Once again, that's joindeleteme.com/warroom, code WARROOM. The link also is in our show notes. Hey, James, our guest is Anna Greta Rasmussen, the editor-in-chief and U.S. correspondent for POV and a leading expert on everything Danish. Anna Greta, thanks for being with us. Trump backed down, sort of, with his threat to take Greenland from Denmark by force. Is there a sense of relief, or you think this is just a pause and there's still trouble ahead?
Oh, I see. Thank you for having me on, first of all. And no, relief is not a word associated with Trump, Mr. Trump, I think. I think your president does not give relief to anybody, maybe his core base from time to time. But here in Denmark and in NATO, I think that nervous and anxious, and that's a more, you know, appropriate term. I know that our politicians have said, our foreign minister, after Davos, he said that the day ended better than it started. And obviously that's true. Trump did back down, as you say. But I don't think anybody dares being, you know, relaxed or relieved. And that's not just because of the substance of the matter. It's also because his general, I mean, we watch him a lot. And he changes his mind a lot.
He does. That's because he doesn't really believe in anything, so he has to change his mind situationally. But let me see if I'm right. Since 1951, the United States has had access to bases in Greenland. Once we had 17. I think there's only one now. Why isn't that the perfect solution to this, just to expand those numbers of bases in the same conditions that they existed before?
Well, you're speaking like a Dane, Al. We think that's the perfect solution. And in Denmark, there is a big sort of like, we're bewildered. Why doesn't the US just open some more bases? Why don't you guys, I mean, you guys, sorry, I know it's not you guys, but that's how we think about it. Why does America not just stock up its base? You know, I mean, as you said, it used to be huge. There used to be many. Now there's very, very little. So you could be very sort of cheeky and say, well, it's actually America that's withdrawn from Greenland. It's not the Danes not wanting to do anything. And I mean, by the way, your listeners should know that Denmark has also pushed in NATO circle to actually do more in the Arctic. And we didn't get through the last time we tried, according to our government. So yes, that would be the perfect solution. But when you say, why isn't that then the solution? I mean, that is what Denmark has proposed. But as far as we can tell, the reason why your president, that Mr. Trump is not happy with that, is because of his way of being a real estate guy. I mean, I think there are two layers, actually. He wants to, as far as we can see, he wants to own something. I mean, he said it very clearly in his speech in Davos. Before he sort of backed down, he said, who the hell wants to defend anything you don't own? Which I'm sure your listeners will appreciate how nervous that makes all NATO countries. Because does he want to own Poland? Does he want to own the Baltic states in order to defend them? I mean, I spent New Year's Eve in Estonia. They are worried. I mean, they're scared shitless. Sorry for my language. But I mean, so we understand that he wants to own something. And as far as I know, I think it was the New York Times that reported it first. One possible compromise could be giving up tiny bits of sovereignty in Greenland over some bases like the Brits do in Cyprus. But as soon as that was out, Mark Rutte, the NATO Secretary General and Trump's best boyfriend in NATO, according to text messages, and I say that to be naughty, actually. He did a very good job, I think, getting Trump down from his very high tree. So we shouldn't say bad things about Mark Rutte. But
go ahead.
Well, no, I won't. as soon as that was out, first the Danes. Our Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, said that's the red line. We're not giving up any sovereignty. Then the Greenland Premier went out and said the same. Jens Frederik Nielsen went out and said we're not even discussing sovereignty and definitely not in a room where we're not present, but we're not giving up anything anyway. So I mean, that's sort of a no-starter, I think. But whether Trump realizes that, I mean, I suppose there's a reason for why he's called 2 weeks Trump. I mean, you know that better than I do. I mean, his preferred deadline is 2 weeks. And sure enough, when he was asked, when's the Greenland agreement ready? He'll say, I think in about 2 weeks. That's obviously baloney. Nothing is even happening in 2 weeks. But I mean, I think that what the Danes could be willing to do, one of our best newspapers in Denmark, sadly not my own, POV International doesn't have that kind of resources, but one of our really good newspapers, I would say the sister newspaper for the Wall Street Journal called Berlingske, they had a very good account of a meeting, a pre-meeting that Mark Rutte had with the Danes before Davos. And there, apparently, they discussed reopening the base agreement from 1951. And if that satisfies Mr. Trump, it's sort of like enlarging something that you already have, then that would probably satisfy the Danes and Greenland and NATO, because we want more American presence. I mean, we do want America to be there with the rest of us looking after the Arctic and Greenland, but we don't want to give away, or they don't want to give away, Greenland and Denmark's sovereignty.
Well, you make a really good point, because the one thing Trump is right about is that Greenland, the Arctic, are strategically important, more so now than ever.
Yeah.
But what you're talking about, that's, you know, going back to the 1951 agreement, 17 bases or ever many bases, that really addresses that issue. I mean, when Trump says Denmark is not up to that task of defending Greenland. Well, if you have 17 American bases there that are not sovereign, but you meet the national security issue he's talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could also argue that, I mean, you know, all the embassies around the world, they actually have their own jurisdiction. I mean, if you are in an embassy, you're part of that country's jurisdiction, even though you're not, like, technically owning the land. And you could argue that if you have bases, okay, and America already has a very, very controversial in Denmark agreement about that the Danish authorities cannot legally go after U.S. soldiers in Denmark. They would have to be sent home to face charges if they did something criminal. I mean, you could argue that that is a kind of, not sovereignty in the legal sense of the word, but it is a way of saying when you're in a U.S. base, you're on U.S. ground, U.S. rules apply. And again, that might satisfy Mr. Trump, but I think you're absolutely right. I know this podcast is not particularly friendly to your own president, but I would say that I agree with you.
Well, you might say
that. Yeah, you might say that. But I agree with you that if you have to give Trump credit, and as a U.S. correspondent for a reputable media, I really want to be, you know, fair in my analysis as myself. And I have said for a long time that when Trump boasts that he got the NATO countries to contribute more, I think he's right. It's not popular in Europe that he says that, but I think he's right. And I mean, I've been covering U.S. presidents since the Obama 1.0, and he also talked a lot about how Europe had to do more, and there was the pivot to Asia and all of that, and Europe must look after itself a bit more. I think a lot of presidents have said that. And
Eisenhower did 70 years ago.
I think it's
ago.
Fair
right.
to give Trump that one. And as such, it's not true that Russian and China, I mean, and that there are Chinese and Russian warships encircling Greenland. I don't know where that comes from. That's absolutely factually not true. But again, as is often the case with Mr. Trump, there is a kernel of truth in it, in as far as with climate change, new sea routes open. It's obviously attractive to both China and Russia. And it's obviously the rare earth minerals are difficult to get to. It's very cold and icy in Greenland. But obviously there is a strategic interest there. And I know that some years ago, the Chinese tried to be part of opening and financing a new airport in Greenland. And the Americans went to the Danes and said, that's not a good idea. And then the Danish government stepped up and helped financing that. So we want to, don't get us wrong, we might be very depressed over the president. There are demonstrations in Copenhagen this weekend. There's a huge, huge anger, feeling of betrayal in Denmark. You know, like really, like domestic violence, you know, you have this partner you trust and then he tries to stab you in the back. That's how it feels in Denmark. But we still would like to repair that relationship. We want NATO to be present and we want America to be part of what's, you know, to do more in Greenland. Our prime minister said that last week when she visited Greenland, and we do want that. So obviously, everybody is working on getting America back on board. And I also think the government, as governments tend to be, if they're rational, our government is interested in having good relations with America. They want to repair this. The Danes, not so much. I mean, I am in shock myself. I mean, I'm Danish. I go back to Denmark all the time, and never in my almost 40 years as a journalist have I experienced a bigger anger. I mean, today I was trying to say to furious readers who believe that your midterm elections will be cancelled and there is a civil war about to break out. And I find myself in a very new role, like a sort of, not a Trump whisperer perhaps, but a US whisperer, saying, no. I mean, the midterms are in the States. There is no role for the president. And then all these Danes are just like, yeah, okay, smart guy or smart girl. We know there's going to, you know, civil war is just about to arrive. And I try to say, oh, well, 50 people was killed at the Rodney King riots. Do you remember Black Lives Matter? I mean, it looks very, very violent to us, what's happening in Minnesota. But there's no civil war about to break out, but they don't believe me. And that is a sense of betrayal that's coming from your big friend attacking and wanting to steal Greenland.
Well, I sure hope you're right about that. I got to tell you, I worry some days. James Carville, you worry. Take over.
So you and I have hung out a lot in Denmark.
We have.
I've spoke to, I don't know, must have been a 50, 60 journalists on one occasion and then probably 25 on another occasion. For our viewers to know, my great-grandfather was born in Copenhagen. Actually, I saw his house he grew up in on St. Ank Street, A-N-K-T, I think, or something is in Danish, St. Ann Street. But tell us about, because people sometimes say Denmark, hey, someplace, what are some Danish brands that Americans are familiar with? You know, what are things that are made in Denmark that are sort of part of our everyday life? This is not some folly remove. You're not in Tibet somewhere. You actually, we come into contact a lot with Denmark.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're such a big country. And I always tell my readers that there is no such thing as America. There are lots of places in America that are more or less American. I mean, most Danes love New York City. And I usually say, no, that's not America. New York City is the most European of all cities in America. But I can try to say what I think is generally known about Denmark. And I think that many people will know Danish things without maybe realizing they're Danish. So I think most American parents know Lego, right? I mean, every child plays Lego. Okay, that's a big Danish brand. Recently, of course, you have Ozempic, you have Novo Nordisk, which is the biggest Danish company, and indeed, sometimes competing with our GDP, it's been so big, Wegovy and Ozempic. So diabetic people will know, and people who know people with diabetes will know the Danish brand Novo. That's two things. Then older Americans, and hopefully also some of your youngest people, even though, I mean,
we qualify.
Well, reading is down. No, I'm talking about little people, Al, not you guys. But Hans Christian Andersen used to be a world brand in fairy tales. I'm very worried as a mom of four that nobody's reading anymore. But I think that Hans Christian Andersen is probably out on podcasts and videos and like you guys. So that's another Danish brand. If you go up to modern times and not commercial like Lego and Novo, I think that the Danish concept of hygge, as you call it, we call it hygge. But hygge is sort of like coziness in America. It's like candles and warmth and especially in the winter, you know, hot cocoa, tea, you wrap yourself up in blankets, you're really sweet and nice to each other. That concept of hygge I've seen in all American bookstores again and again, I think probably by Danish authors or Americans with Danish ancestry like James, profiting on that. If you go to sort of elite circles, and I'm sure a lot of elite people, although very unpopular with your current government, having formed an alternative elite, a bit like alternative facts, I suppose. But in the elite, the old elite, I think there are some popular Danish stuff. There is, for instance, the Danish series Borgen, which Hillary and Bill Clinton have said is their favorite TV show. It's been adapted and sent in America. There are also several films, Netflix films that are Danish. And I think Hygge is very big, but the biggest promoter of all things Danish is Mr. Bernie Sanders. I have hung out with him a bit too. And of course, if Bernie had his way, you guys would be Danish. I mean, he wants Denmark. He wants everything we have. He wants, you know, universal healthcare. You know, he wants 1 year maternity leave. He wants all colleges in America to be free. I mean, colleges in Denmark are not just free. You get a stipend from the state, kind of salary to study. You have excellent elder care. All right, not always excellent, but better elder care. You have a lot of things that are free because we, not me, because I don't live here, but the rest of them pay the world's highest income taxes. And usually when I talk about Denmark to an American audience, especially your young people, they love all that, you know, maternity leave, elder care, free healthcare. But then when their parents are present, and sometimes they are, and they hear our tax rates, they sort of go off that idea. And Bernie never speaks about the tax rate, really. But I think that Bernie Sanders managed in 2016 to get Denmark on place 3 or 4 in the Washington Post's list over what was discussed during the primaries when he had debates, Hillary and Bernie and all the rest of them. Denmark was actually so much discussed that Hillary, at some point, Clinton, she got irritated. And she said, well, we are not in Denmark, Bernie Sanders, Senator. We are in America. So I think Bernie is a great poster boy for all things Danish. And of course, we have the Danish caucus in Washington, Steny Hoyer, who's now retiring, but he's the chairman of that. So I think, you know, there are a lot of things going for Denmark in both elite circles. The New Yorker and Monocle are often in Copenhagen. You know, we used to have the world's best restaurant, Noma. And we have a lot of bakeries and films and things. So I think if you go to this elite audience, that the people who read the New Yorker, bless them, there are very few of them, they would like to go to Denmark and study the Scandinavian welfare state, basically. So that's, I know James has said evil things about NPR. Isn't it something about old liberal ladies lecturing American males about not eating vegetables and behaving themselves? I happen to be a huge NPR fan. I listen all the time. And I think that Denmark is also often featured, you know, with NPR and their guests about, you know, a place where people are nice to each other.
Okay, so my quarrel with NPR is they use archaic language. It's not English. I always think you should broadcast in your native tongue. I think Maserac is a Danish-owned company, which is, if you're in New Orleans, you see Maserac is a shipping company. You see their containers everywhere, all over the world.
Yeah, Maersk, okay. Yes. It's the world's biggest shipper, isn't it?
Lest someone think this is just some nice people in Northern Europe, you know, really. Tell us the story about the Danes and the Holocaust in World War II and how clever they were unlike other places when it came to treatment of the Jews.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I think it's a great story.
It is a great story. When I arrived in Washington, D.C. as a correspondent in 2008, one of the first things I did was to revisit the Holocaust Museum, where I'd been as a guest. I was a guest of your government, of the State Department, back in 1995, where the visit to the Holocaust Museum was also on the program. And I was very honored back then to see that Denmark has its own room at the Holocaust Museum, where there is on display a fishing boat. And the reason why it's a boat is because that was the way that almost all, not quite, but almost all Danish Jews escaped to Sweden. They were sent over in small fishing boats. But the background for that was not just practical, that the Danes wanted to, you know, ship these people over and away to safety. It was also part of a narrative which was different in Denmark than many other places. And that was that the Danish authorities and the Danish royals, but also in general, refused to see the Jews as other. You know, they were not others. They were Danes. They were Danish citizens. So an attack on the Jews was an attack on the Danes. And that is, for me personally, there are lots of individual stories about these families that escaped, and they are touching and moving. But to me, the principle that was important during the Second World War and the horrors there was that the Danes did not see the Jews as others. And therefore, almost all Jews in Denmark escaped to Sweden and was spared the horrors that happened, not just in Germany, but also, you know, in other countries that Danes normally feel that we are sort of related to. A lot of Danes think we're almost like the Dutch. For instance, we share a lot of these sort of laid-back liberal values with the Dutch, but that was certainly not what happened there. And of course, there were Danish Nazis, and of course, the Danish government was accused of being much too placid and too, you know, like scared. But in the end, they did resign. And then there were the sort of romantic myths, which were true, that the Danish king at the time was, you know, riding every morning on a white horse around Copenhagen, but becoming a symbol of, you know, we're not backing down. There was plays, there were songs that were sort of that went under the radar in the German censors, so that you could sing those songs and they were really about the Nazis. So I think that until Montgomery saved us, and that's of course part of, you know, part of our history. I think Mette Frederiksen, our prime minister, was recently, and all of Denmark was very honored about that, because let's face it, Denmark is just like a village. We're like 6 million people, smaller than New York City, half of London. We were very honored in Denmark to see our prime minister on the front page of the New York Times in an interview. Even she mentions Montgomery. And at the end of the article, she says, "We don't forget. We don't forget what your country did for us. We don't forget how you are related to us, how we share values." But circling back to your own question, Al, how does this feel now? That is how it feels. I mean, if you have a country with a history, and then you have this feeling that the president of this country that used, you know, that saved you during the Second World War, he doesn't care about values. He only cares about transactions, and he doesn't think he gets enough out of the transaction he thinks he has with NATO. I mean, you know, the shocking thing about how the soldiers from the other NATO countries didn't stand up for Americans is a lie. But more than that, his thing about, you know, what has NATO ever done for us is like completely shocking to hear him say that, because we thought we were in it together. And of course, looking factually at it and not just emotionally, the NATO countries do contribute to the US safety as well. And I don't think Mr. Trump is really aware of that, or he doesn't care, maybe. I don't know.
So I want a real quick question to go back to Al. I read, I can't tell you about it, you know, I'm old and I forget shit, but I read somewhere that the Danes had, per capita, had the highest casualty rate in Afghanistan of any country.
Yes.
That is correct.
Listen to this.
Citizens of the United States of America, post 9/11, in Afghanistan, Denmark per capita lost more people than any other country.
Yes, okay? That is correct.
That's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fact.
That is a fact.
Thank you for verifying that. Thank you for verifying that. And we're going to go back to St. Anne Street.
I would like to add to that, James, that we also per capita contribute more to NATO and Ukraine than America. But okay, we are very small, so I don't want to ever mention that as a benchmark.
There's an expression we use here a lot. You punch above your weight.
That is what Mr. Obama kindly said about us and about 30 other countries. But we felt it. We felt we were proud, yeah.
All right, Al, go ahead. But that does bring up, you said earlier that, you know, that Danes, that your prime minister wants to repair relations, wants to get back. Though after what you've been through and after watching what Trump does, Americans elect a Democrat in 2029, say, okay, we're back again, everything is normal. Aren't there going to be skeptics who say, can we really trust America again? Mm-hmm. Hasn't this created, you know, more than just a temporary issue, a temporary blip?
Absolutely. I mean, yes, I think you're right. I mean, it's shocking that it takes so little time to break something that's so been so long. But yes, I don't think that the Danes will immediately trust America. Not Americans, because a lot of Danes have super friendly relationships with, you know, friends and families and so on. But yes, I think that it will take a long time, and I'm not at all sure whether it's possible to get back to anything we had before. But then people who are cleverer than me also say that NATO is in a, you know, like coma, hospice. I mean, the question is not just whether the Danes can repair their relationship with America. Right. It's also whether NATO can ever recover. there are lots of really clever people. I've seen them everywhere, New York Times, The Guardian, podcasts, television, who say, no, it's finished. You know, from Anne Applebaum to Timothy Garton Ash to lots of retired NATO people who are saying it's finished, it's done. But of course, we don't want to think that. And again, if I may use the domestic violence analogy, I mean, maybe you can repair the relationship to a spouse that has shouted at you and threatened you and been violent with you, and you can repair after therapy and you can get back because you love each other. But can you ever trust that person again? Right. I don't know. I can't answer that. I can only say that in government circles, that is the wish. But whether the people will follow, I'm not sure. They don't have anybody to vote for that wants something else. I mean, all parties in Denmark stand united about this. And that is what you could say the positive Trump effect that we saw in Canada. I mean, as you know, the Liberal Party was heading towards a big loss. Then Trump threatened Canada and whoopty, Mark Carney replaced Trudeau. And it's the same here. Our prime minister was what was said in the New York Times was actually wrong. She was not leading in the polls. She was actually down and the government was extremely unpopular. But after Trump, boom. The government is up. She's super popular again. So I think the Trump effect, it could be that maybe she gets reelected later in the year. That was not the expectation. So there are no parties in Denmark that don't want to repair this relationship. But will the people follow? Will there ever be trust again? I'm completely uncertain about that. I don't know.
I'm going to turn this back to James, but I'm going to retell a story that we told last week or the week before. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, President Kennedy sent Dean Acheson to see de Gaulle to show him pictures of the Russians installing missiles. And de Gaulle said, I don't need to see the pictures. I have the word of the United States of America. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to imagine that occurring today. And that's the task of trying to repair, which I think is going to be very, very hard.
Yes.
So I hope I'm wrong. James?
So let's continue on our Danish education mission here for just a second. If you talk to most Americans, that was kind of the same way. Yeah, they're kind of nice blonde people running around, you know, with heavy coats in the wintertime and kind of mind their own business. They're very orderly people. And then, of course, I go to Copenhagen, and there's a neighborhood in Copenhagen called Christiana.
Yes.
I think I'm pronouncing it right. That's not a very conformist place. Now, is it?
No.
tell us about Christiana, because they claim they're not even in the EU. Mm-hmm. There's a sign. You're now leaving the EU. Tell us about how they don't conform in Christiana.
Right. Well, it's called the Free City of Christiania, and it's very close to where your ancestors, I know you've been out to see the house, James, in the street
right
of
there.
Christianshavn.
Yes, it's right there.
And Christianshavn in Danish means the harbor of Christian. So that's Christiania is just around the corner from your ancestral house.
Correct.
But yes, the Free City of Christiania was created back in the start 70s, where a group of squatters thought that it was sad that this area, which is very, very beautiful, is like moat. You know, there is like water right. and green, and it's very pretty. And it's in Copenhagen, which is, of course, you know, rare. We don't have that many places like that. But it was military, and it was abandoned. So these squatters took over. And then we actually circled straight back to what I said before and what you just said in a little bit of a sort of ironic tone about the coziness and the happiness. As you know, Denmark is the world's happiest country. We are, you know, we win again and again and again in that competition, only occasionally being beaten by Norway, I think. So instead of bulldozing the whole thing down, I mean, you could say instead of putting in like border control officers or ICE people or whatever, we don't really have that kind of thing in Denmark. But of course, we have some like special forces. So you could have bulldozed and arrested all those people. There were not many, few hundreds. Instead, they barricaded themselves and started building like a hippie. It was just sort of one big Woodstock thing. And later came a lot of drugs and it was problematic. But various Danish governments kept saying, because it was like if you had a federal area, we don't have federal and local like that in Denmark, but we do have state and local. So this was a state area because it was military. So the state kept wanting these people out. And instead, it just became bigger and bigger and bigger. And people started to move out there. They started to establish themselves with electricity. They tapped into the electricity, which was there already. They had their own mailboxes. They started their own kindergartens. They had a very, for some years, when I was very young in the 80s, sort of mid-80s, start 90s, they established these huge musical facilities, which still exist. So a lot of big bands play there. There is a very renowned kitchen, several restaurants. So, I mean, various governments tried and tried and tried the nice way. We never do the, you know, Trump says we can do it the nice way or the nasty way, but we don't really have the nasty way. So government tried the nice way and it failed. Then they tried to police it better, especially because a lot of drugs were sold there. And then very much in the sort of hippie tradition, the people who lived there, the Christianias, or whatever you want to call them in English, they did leave the EU, they said, and they did establish their own postal code and all of that. But they are, of course, that's not real. But let's just assume that they feel like that. When they saw that they were threatened from the inside, because a lot of Danes didn't like the chaos, you know, they could not bear to see these clashes between the drug police forces that cleared the streets out there. There was a very famous street called Pusher Street, where in the start it was just cannabis and that was tolerated, but then it became hard drugs. But then the people that lived there did it very Danish way. They called in all the citizens for a huge meeting, like a town hall meeting, and decided enough is enough. You guys have to leave. And they were not nice people, the people that they wanted to get rid of. It was Hell's Angels that ran, and it was drug cartels or gangs that ran that. They pushed them out. They're gone. Today, it's very peaceful. It's a big tourist attraction, and a lot of people go there, and the government finally decided to normalize the place. So it's no longer under threat. It will never be closed down. It's the free city of Christiania, and all you American readers that go to Copenhagen, don't just go to see the Little Mermaid, who, I shame on me, I forgot to mention her when you asked about all things Danish, but she's sort of connected to Hans Christian Andersen. Don't just go to Tivoli Gardens, the world's oldest amusement park. Don't just go to see the Little Mermaid or to visit some shishi restaurant with a Michelin star. There are a few of those. But please go out there to see, you know, walk around with the canals, see the Danes in, you know, relaxed mode. There's also a lot of winter bathing. You know, it's very popular as it is in America, you know, ice tubs and bakeries. And it's quite a cozy place. I would say Christiania today is a very cozy place.
And sorry, still part of the EU.
Don't tell them that.
Tell your friends at the tourist board that my suggested slogan is, we're Denmark.
Yes.
Hey, we got a little rogue in us.
Yes.
All right, Al, go ahead.
No, you've been terrific. Well, we have learned, first of all, we learned more about the situation that Trump has caused, the problems, but also we have had a lesson in everything Danish, and at least it makes me want to go to Copenhagen and then the rest of Denmark as soon as possible. I may even stop over in Greenland on the way.
Do. Please come.
Get your best sleep with Miracle Sheets. They're essential, and because I live in what most people consider a tropical, subtropical climate, you know, cool sheets make a lot. But even, it doesn't matter what time of year, your body comes into contact with sheets way more than it comes into contact with most anything else. And boy, you know, we preach the gospel of please get a good night's sleep on this show because it's so determinative of your productivity the next day. And you want to use everything you got in these sheets. You got a lot to bring to the party here. Yeah, these things work well.
If you ever wake up sweaty, freezing, or just uncomfortable, just take it from James. The temperature in your bedroom can make or break your sleep. That's why you need to switch to Miracle-Made sheets. They're inspired by NASA technology and use silver-infused temperature-regulating fabric to help you sleep perfectly all night long. Sleeping at the right temperature is a critical way to feel rested the next day. And whether it's too hot or too cold, Miracle Sheets truly give you maximum comfort in any weather. They even make pillowcases and comforters. Plus, thanks to their antibacterial silver technology, Miracle Sheets require way less laundry because they stay clean and fresh three times longer. Not only is that fewer wash cycles, but it's great for your skin. Hidden bacteria can clog your pores and cause acne. So sleep cleaner and clearer with Miracle. Trust us, with no more gross odors, life is a whole lot better for the household. So join us in getting better sleep every night. Not only are Miracle sheets smooth, breathable, and ridiculously comfortable, they don't have the steep price tag of other luxury brands. Miracle sheets feel nicer than bed sheets used by some five-star hotels. So it's a vacation every time you get into bed. I always imagine myself in Italy, but it's your call. Drift off to dreamland and wake up at the perfect temperature every time you get into bed. Choose Miracle to upgrade your sleep or give the gift of better rest. Go to trymiracle.com/warroom to try Miracle-made sheets today. You'll save over 40%, and when you use the promo code WARROOM, you'll get an extra 20% off plus a free 3-piece towel set. They make an amazing gift, and with a 30-day money-back guarantee, there's no risk. That's trymiracle.com/warroom with the code WARROOM at checkout. Thanks to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. The link is also in our show notes. All right, now for the outrage of the week. There's so many. The Trump Board of Peace may be the biggest scam farce since the old corrupt Enron board. The rules say it's run by Trump now, tomorrow, and forever, even after he leaves office. He gets to approve the members. Almost all the members are countries now run by dictators, democratically run countries. Remember, they used to be our most important allies. They really want no part of this. Oh, yes, those acclaimed diplomats and moneymakers, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, are members. One result I'll confidently predict will come out of this fraudulence. It will line Trump's pockets, as that's what he's all about in whatever endeavor he undertakes.
Okay, thank you. Mine is I rise in praise and admiration for a columnist of the New York Times, whose name is Michelle Goldberg. I know her not well, but I've intersected with her a couple of times. It struck me as a perfectly nice person. But she wrote a column that I think really stands out. And it was about two comedians that were making jokes about Jasmine Crockett not having as good a chance to win. And, of course, the online identitarians slaughtered them to the point that they had to do some kind of hostage tape that they're sorry that they were offended at what they were deeply misogynistic and racist or whatever shit they come up with. And Michelle pointed this out and did it very, very, very effectively. So I want to address the Democratic coalition. Now, there are two people you can be. You can be an identitarian, and you can say your identity is the most important thing to you, and people in identity politics should reign supreme in a Democratic Party, and anybody that suggests otherwise is a horrible, can't believe it, what a sorry-ass person. Now, there's another side of the Democratic Party that says winning is everything, stupid. If you don't win, you haven't done shit. Okay, you're just sitting there, you got one stump dug up your ass and one in your mouth, and you're switching every 5 seconds. And the truth of the matter is, I am for James Alrico and not Jasmine Crockett. It doesn't have anything to do with anybody's identity, okay? Get this through your stupid fucking head. This has got to do with their ability to articulate a message, their framing of issues, and how do you identify with Texans in a year that we have a good chance to win? You don't do it by making fun of people in wheelchairs. That's not a good idea, okay? You don't do it by saying that Hispanic people that voted for Trump have a slave mentality. That is not the way you get people, okay? That's not. Let's do this thing. Let's get Jim Talrico nominated. Let's take this thing to the general election and rewrite with it. But all you identity shits, listen to me. Join the winning side, because that's what we're getting ready to do. We're getting ready to win. And that is the most important consideration for any voter in any Democratic primary. Who can win the fucking general election? That's it.
Well said. And now we have our listener questions. Once again, they're coming from all over the world, James, and they are good. Many focus on Minneapolis this week. We've covered a lot of that in the show, so I'm not going to do as many of those. But please keep them coming. We'll start with Karen in Oakland, California. She says, everyone seems excited by Trump's tanking poll numbers. But if they're currently the same as his post-January 6 numbers, and America says, sign me up again, how can we have hope that the electorate this time is going to tune out on Trump?
Okay, this is a good question. And remember, we lost the election because we insisted on not giving people change when they wanted it. And this has always been my belief, and it continues my belief, the people that really got Trump back in the White House were Biden, by staying in the race and then not letting Harris be for anything, any change, anything else. But it is true, he won the election. And what we know is we can't let this out of conscience. I think the images of this are, in some ways, is powerful, more powerful than the January 6th images. But we're going to pursue this. And the fissures that they leave behind in the White House are really, really, really big. And, you know, we keep saying, how does the son of a bitch keep getting away with it? I'm beginning to think he's not getting away with it anymore. That we're in that he is in some permanent decline. And, but we'll see, but we got to keep this ball rolling.
Yeah. Yeah. Anne in Mequon, Wisconsin, says, ask good question. What inspired 7 House Blue Dog Democrats to vote to give more money to ICE? Even some Republicans are getting wary. Anne, you're right. You're absolutely right. They made a bad calculation that somehow they could justify it by saying this is funding also for FEMA and other things that Homeland Security has done. A number of them, Tom Suozzi in New York, now say that was a mistake. I shouldn't have voted for that. And they encouraged the Senate to hold tough on that. You can't just pretend that we can fund ICE the way you did last year when you look at what's happening in Minneapolis. So I think that they made a mistake, and I give Tom Suozzi credit for acknowledging it.
I agree. I saw Tom's statement. I said, you know, I think there was just this reflexive thing because some jackass Democrat I never heard of talked about defund ICE. Somebody thought that was, of course, ICE is one thing. Customs and, you know, immigration are things that we have to deal with. And I agree. It's a good point. And they shouldn't have done it in the first place without some kind of assurances, but that's okay. They saw the error of their ways and we should move on.
Scarlett in Helena, Montana, asks, would it be a mistake for Democrats to completely drop support for transgender people instead of just stepping back from wasting energy on the most controversial fights like sports?
Our transgender people or human beings are just entitled to every right that every other person has. I think we should pay even more attention to them because the outcomes here, I mean, I've seen a lot of good research, and these kids are more likely to commit suicide, more likely to have drug problems, more likely to have problems for the rest of their life. And the last thing in the world that we need to do is give any sense that we anti-transgender people in any shape or form. Some of it has spoken, and I kind of think appropriately on athletics and I call it girls' sports in high school, it's women's sports in college. And I understand the point that, you know, so well, they should be able to compete as to the identity that they have assumed for themselves. But I don't think that's, I guess it's called your assigned gender birth, I don't know what they call it, but whatever you're born at. And some of these people identify as female or still male, but they have different records, they're different things. And so your daughter runs the 400 meters and you go to every track meeting, she's training and working really hard. And then she's competing against somebody who athletically wise is male. That's not fair. And I see that, but I think we have serious obligations to transgender people, and we should have a lot more support for them, particularly when they're young.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is invisible. The mean-spirited attacks from right-wingers on transgender kids is really just horrifying. They ought to be supported in every way possible.
Absolutely.
I think that is a different issue than the sports issue. And my view on the sports issue is politicians stay the hell out of it. You don't know a goddamn thing about it. It ought to be left to the schools, to the athletic conferences. They can set up any rules they want to on that. But, Paul, you know, I tell you, sitting here in Washington or state legislature in Indiana, you don't know anything about this. So turn it over to people. But, you know, I think, Scarlett, it would be a mistake to turn our backs on transgender people. They are, as James said, people.
Terrible mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we have athletic associations, you know, the high school athletes. Let them worry about the 400 meters. You don't need to worry about that.
Yeah. James, as I said, we have a number of ICE questions. I'm going to just combine two from John in Sonoma, California, and Meg in Canada. John asked, with everything bad that's going on, the videos and sinking poll numbers, will Trump fire Miller? And the other, Meg in Canada, says, is defund the ICE right back the same way defund the police was? It turns a bad issue for Republicans into a good issue. First of all, for John, I agree. He may well fire Miller. I don't know. I also don't know what difference it'll make, other than, as James said earlier, we won't have to look at Stephen Miller. The problem is not Stephen Miller or Pete Hegseth or RFK. Tulsi Gabbard is the entire Justice Department. The problem is Donald Trump. So, we'll see what happens there. And Meg, defund ICE is insane. You need an immigration and customs enforcement. It's reform ICE, improve ICE, make ICE responsible, make them better. In that sense, it is analogous to the defund the police. You didn't want to defund police. You wanted to reform police. You wanted to make better cops, as a lot of communities have. And I think that situation is true with ICE today.
You know, I just had to start. That is crazy. Of course, you have to have customs immigration enforcement. Maybe you call it something else, ICE. Maybe they have so tainted the name. Maybe, we continue to call the FBI, done all kinds of shit, but we still call it the FBI. Okay, maybe when the Democrats get control of everything, maybe they should change the name so we know that this period of this horrific overreach, this horrific trampling on people's constitutional rights, this has become an anti-American organization. Maybe it helps just to get rid of the fucking name. All right? I agree you have to have the kind of enforcement, you have to have these laws, but nowhere is it written in the Constitution that you got to call it ICE. So let's have a contest. Who can come up with a better name for it?
Yes, that's a good idea. Send in any emails or letters on what could be a new name for the immigration and customs enforcement.
And remember, there are a lot of good people that probably worked there. People have been working for the government for a long time, very conscientious. Let's don't straddle them with this name, okay? We can come up with something better than ICE.
James, you got a couple of questions from across the pond. Frank in Athens, Greece. Says, is there a risk Trump's going to deploy the National Guard to Democratic cities and states to seize voting machines and absentee ballots, claiming rampant fraud? I'm worried. Could you give me some hope?
I can't give any hope because I can't tell you they won't. I think it's maybe as likely as not that he does. But we're going to be talking about it a lot on this show. We promised to do a whole show on how they could possibly do that. And then we got to set up defenses because we're not without defenses. But your question is well taken. It's one that we on this podcast take very, very seriously.
I'm deeply worried, Frank. And I think it's you raise a really important issue. If they think they're going to lose this election, which they almost certainly are, they'll do anything. they being Trump. So Chase in Kidderminster, UK, says, how do we actually get back to the greatness of America? And ask me specifically, why do the Sunday morning talk shows just sit there and allow the administration to gaslight the American people? It's going to take a long time to get back to where we were, Chase. I think you're a little unkind to Sunday morning. Sunday morning shows are not nearly as important as they were 25 years ago for a simple reason. There are all kinds of shows during the week. It used to be when I was, you know, starting in Washington for most of the time, you know, Sunday mornings were the only time you really had public affairs interviews. Now there's a lot. But I noted earlier in the show the great job that Dana Bash did last week. And my old colleague, Margaret Brennan, has certainly risen to the occasion. So I don't think that that's a problem or a big problem. Yeah, there's some gaslighting going on, but I think they do a pretty good job of holding them accountable.
Yes, very good point. Look, in the 90s, I was doing Sunday morning TV, you know, all the time, and it was, people would pay attention, and it just, the media landscape has changed, but they still have a kind of important role, and I don't think it's fair to say, like, George Stephanopoulos has backed off his criticism of Donald Trump. I know that has not happened, and I think it, although it doesn't hold the same place of prominence, I think they've been pretty aggressive. On the country getting better, I disagree with you. I think as soon as the election of 2028 is complete, I think the country's going to get a lot better. I'll tell you why I think it's going to get a lot better. Because it wants to get better. Americans don't like living like this. They don't want this to be who we are. They want us to be a better country. They're going to elect a Democrat in 2028. And that person has got to say, we have a monumental job to build our relationships with other countries, and the government has a monumental job to build its relations with its citizens, and I can't do this by myself. I need the help of the public, and the public is going to help, and they're going to help for a simple reason. They want to get better. They want to get better. They don't like this national infected tooth that we're all living with. They're going to get rid of it.
Just a final note on the Sunday morning talk shows, a remembrance that we'll never see again. They used to talk about the Russert primary. Tim Russert was such a huge figure that if a politician wanted to run for president, they had to go on, meet the press with Tim Russert and prove their mettle. There are many reasons that we miss the great Tim Russert. Chris in Covington, Louisiana, I got to return to you, James. Says, who is the speechwriter for Prime Minister Carney at Davos? That speech was a masterclass in comparative political systems in the Trumpian era. Do we have any speakers on that level who are currently putting themselves out there?
Well, first of all, it was a magnificent speech. Second, Canadians to a very talented people. And just go, they're cutting their own deals. And a thing that we didn't talk about today that I think we're going to talk about some more was this deal that the EU just cut with India. The danger we have is the world is doing a workaround. And Mark Carney has said, for the longest time, Canadians have thought, well, you know, our relationship with the U.S. is a cornerstone of our prosperity, our being, and something like that. Just, you know what? Shit, we're a successful country, and we'll just do a workaround. And the next president got to be skilled enough to bring people like that back in to reestablish the goodwill that the United States had with its neighbors that has worked very well for all of us. By the way, and this is something to explore more, there's some people that are really getting increasingly worried about the dollar. We got to get Roger Altman on here to see if there's what are the dangers of this, or is this something that just too many people are fretting about that'll never happen? I don't know the answer to that, but I think it's something worth looking into, because if the dollar loses dominance, then we're fucked pretty good, I believe, but we'll explore that.
Yeah, I always thought it was kind of the fringe people who said buy gold, which I'm not going to do, but there are a lot of people out there who are doing it today because they're so worried about the dollar.
I did. My wife did. I thought she was crazy. I don't think she's crazy anymore.
Yeah. All right, listen, we love those questions. We get to as many as we can. If we didn't get to yours this week, please send it in again and we'll try to get to it next week, because this is one of our favorite parts of every show. So thank you. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, DeleteMe and Miracle Made, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.